This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Wong Xiaoning and Philip C. It has just gone past 6 o'clock in the morning. It's Wednesday, the 31st of March.
The last day of the quarter.
I know, where did the month go? It literally got
eaten
up.
Where did the quarter go?
Before you know it, Philip will be saying, where did the year go?
I know. It's like 25% done.
I know. You consultants, right? You just love putting everything like numerically into like segments, you know?
Look at your mobile and you see the battery of life and you're at 25%. Okay. No, 75% done.
Well, actually, you can think about
it. Time to recharge.
Yeah, well, you can either be very positive about it and say, I've got 75% more to go.
Yep.
Or you can be very depressed and say, oh, you're 25% gone, but what have I done? Which is the big question. But I think what has really changed is the nature of the work. And they say we'll never work the same again because the pandemic has force-fed the workforce the idea of flexible working, and now there's really no looking back. So what will work look like in the future? Join us for a special enterprise webinar where we discuss how to transition seamlessly into the hybrid workplace, how to realign culture, expectations and benefits, and how you can make career choices to ensure you or your company aren't left behind. Happening later today at 1:30 p.m. live on Facebook at BFM Radio.
That's a really timely conversation because I think yesterday Minister Dato Sri Ismail Sabri is going to allow private sector to potentially go back to work in full force already.
Yes.
So very interesting to see how the new shape of work arrangements will shape. And the conversation is going to be very critical.
So yes, you're allowed to go back, but will everybody do so? And in what form and what shape, right?
Yep.
I think I'm going to be watching which companies kind of, adjust. Because some of the global ones like Microsoft, if I'm not wrong, have allowed a slightly more flexible approach towards work. But what about Malaysian companies? Are we sticklers for being in the office? Or are we going to be more liberated and say, okay, flexibility is allowed?
I must say MNCs have very mixed pictures. You know, those who are overly cautious, I find like work from home is like the permanent feature.
Whereas some of my friends at the banks, it has been the case.
Correct. But I think you're right. But in banks also, I think there are many people who are like itching to go back to work. Mm.
I think they don't want to see their children anymore.
Yes.
But what else do we have this morning, Philip?
We're going to talk about Bill Huang. Who is he?
Dot, dot, dot.
I'm sure you all know.
By now, some of us may have heard of him. But interesting character. Interesting. And I'll be talking about training and unconscious biasness, whatever that means. It's very, very, very deep. As always, get in touch with us via WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll have more for you in a few minutes. But first, here's Dear Maker by Led Zeppelin. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was Dear Maker by Led Zeppelin. It's just gone past 6:07 in the morning, and of course, you're listening to The Morning Run. And today's interesting topic is something I never heard about, but obviously I suffer from. And that is
all of us suffer from,
which is our unconscious bias. And it's an article in the BBC Work Life, and it's entitled The Complicated Battle Over Unconscious Bias Training. Now, I think for a lot of multinational companies, maybe, especially, I suppose, in developed countries, it was very common to have a kind of training to help you overcome your unconscious bias. So certain perceptions you have in life, which are, because of the culture that you're in, your background, your upbringing, your education, you might not realize that you have, which aren't exactly fair. Okay.
Yep.
And you bring that into the workplace. So the offices or these MNCs were trying to help these individuals or employees or even bosses overcome it. And KPMG, I believe, was one of these companies that actually used to practice this. But now apparently there's backlash and that it might not be as useful as people think. And so there's been a bit of a stop in terms of the practice. Am I correct, Philip?
That's right. I think the KPMG UK chair, Bill Michael, called the concept of unconscious bias complete and utter C.P. Right?
Dude.
Right? So he wasn't a big fan of it. It's a huge industry, $8 billion worth industry. But I think the key kicker here where people are now thinking about this training is that the UK Civil Service has also decided to end this training. And I find it fascinating because it sounds good to do it because you're kind of trying to address deep-seated prejudices across your organization.
Because the purpose of this in a way is to encourage diversity, right?
Correct. Because women, there's some assumption women cannot be leaders. Mm. In the UK, black men are not competent or too aggressive. So there is an informal structure to try and address that.
By the way, fun fact, the KPMG UK chair, which was, he said that every single unconscious bias training that has ever been done, nothing's ever been improved. That was his comment. And there was a huge outcry and he had to apologize and later resign. So his biasness in terms of this training proved to be his downfall, if anything else.
Well, that's where the article does point out to say, it's not to say it's not effective. It's just that it's not the end-all solution if you really want to truly address it. Because the first point, the first part of anything you do or any journey is discovery. And I guess unconscious bias must have and create difficult conversations and uncomfortable conversations about your deep-seated prejudices and feelings. And if you don't have that discomfort, then it's very hard. So that awareness has to come through. I think the challenge here is that, okay, after you have the awareness, how do you institutionalize it? How do you embed it into your psyche? It's really the core problem here.
Yeah, maybe because the format in which this unconscious bias training that took place was rather redundant. And I can imagine it was one of those maybe people sat through a series of questions online and then they tick, those 50, you know, like go through these 50 pages of this so-called training, do a test, get a result and then, yay, I'm done for the year or I'm done for my lifetime in this company. And really stickly, or even if it's not the case and it's like a one-day training, two-day training with some trainer in front of you and it's not interactive and you're, like you say, Philip, not an honest discussion.
Yeah.
Then it becomes one of those like, I have to do lah, what to do, you know, not my choice. My company makes it compulsory. I'll just go through the motions. And once it's over and done and dusted, you forget it instantly.
Ayo, this is so common. I mean, not only on the element of unconscious bias training. I mean, a classic example of, let's say, sexual harassment training. Many of us think it's a checkbox and tick box. Okay, done 3 hours, habis.
Yeah.
Close book and then let's move on with life.
Or compliance training, anti-money laundering training. A lot of companies have different compulsory training. But I suppose the training is only effective if, like you say, it is meaningful, right? It resonates within you.
Yep.
And it asks some questions that perhaps are uncomfortable to answer, but you need to ask yourself these difficult questions, especially when it comes to unconscious bias. If you're trying to overcome some prejudices you have.
Yeah.
And I think at the same time, besides the training, there needs to be some sort of policy measures. I think training is just one essence of it. If you're really trying to create that, you know, a multicultural, multi-diverse team and you want to hire people from all sorts of backgrounds, right? Then you need to have, in turn, policies which encourage that also simultaneously.
So I think that's where the article concludes by saying diversity breeds more diversity. And I remembered, you know, in the early days when I was recruiting or applying for jobs, right, in investment banks in the UK, there were clear investment banks that said, I am very pro-diversity already. And that was 20 years ago. And I do agree with that. And that's why people are having this discussion about diversity quotas, gender quotas, because they do feel that you need that diversity to breed more diversity. Now, beyond just only having that element, you want to change your recruitment process.
Yes.
You want to encourage more mentoring.
Yes.
I think those are the actions that you've got to take beyond just the checkbox training.
And what is really sad, if I'm not wrong, very recently in Malaysia, there was this law firm that said wanted only pretty female lawyers to apply. Or pretty female you know, people to apply.
Frankly, I'm offended because pretty is pretty subjective.
And it's just disgraceful that in 2021, people are still putting that down as a requirement. I mean,
oh, that's terrible.
It's terrible. But let us know what you think. I mean, should diversity training or gender bias training be something compulsory? Should we relook at this whole concept of it? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Or, of course, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we'll have some messages. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and there was Meeting Place by The Last Shadow Puppets. It's 6:18 in the morning, and of course you're listening to The Morning Run. And Big question of the day. Who is Bill Huang?
Like, where is he?
Where is he? Like Wally, right?
Yeah, where's Wally?
Apparently, well, if you haven't heard, there are lots of investment banks that have lost plenty of money. Plenty of money. And also have seen a lot of their share price come down under pressure. I think Nomura is the one that got the biggest hit. I think close down to 16-17% on a year-to-date basis. And I think the unraveling of Archegos Capital, which started on Friday, has now beginning to be seen from, I think, in terms of the bank's profits. But let's start at the very beginning.
The mastermind.
Yeah.
Who is the mastermind of all of this?
Yes.
But before that, I think it's worth checking out, if you've got time, go and check out the podcast, Opaque World of Leveraged Trading Strategies by Pankaj Kumar. I think we interviewed him. It was a great interview. But we should just deep dive on the personality of Bill Huang.
Yes. Siapa tu?
Siapa tu? Who manages Archegos. Now, a bit of history about Bill Huang, right? He is a protege of hedge fund titan Julian Robertson, who founded Tiger Management. As a result, all these little Tiger Cubs were birthed into the system. And Tiger Cubs included one of these guys called Bill Huang. He then created Tiger Asia and converted it to a family office, which is called Archegos, who manages about $10 billion.
Yes, family office that manages $10 billion but seems to have created utter and complete chaos on Wall Street. Because he did what is this leverage trading strategies, right? And what it is essentially is trading the market with the money you don't have. So he took the $10 billion that he does have in terms of family money and spun it to actually probably have a portfolio that was what, 10, 20, 30, 40
exactly.
times? I don't know. I think people are just starting to find out kind of fund size. And when the margin call happened on Friday, or is it? I think it started probably Wednesday, Thursday.
Midweek last week.
Yeah. Wednesday, Thursday. Yep. And I do believe probably it was Goldman that pulled the first rug, right? And that was probably over the Viacom shares.
That's right.
And that really created a
domino effect.
So you had it with Viacom. Then subsequently, you had it with even some of the listed Chinese tech companies in US. So Baidu got hit.
Baidu, Tencent.
Yeah. And then suddenly you saw all these investment banks reporting huge losses.
Yeah, but
I think the last one, I think, was even last night, JP Morgan.
Correct. But you know, he's been naughty for some time. This is not his first rodeo, right, of naughtiness. He's actually been, in 2008, was involved with a series of losses involving Volkswagen. And he had to pay to settle an insider trading case in 2012 and agreed to pay $44 million in order for the firm to plead guilty to criminal fraud charges to settle civil allegations by U.S. security regulators that engaged in insider trading of Chinese bank stocks. Naughty, naughty.
And apparently he was banned from trading in Hong Kong. And then he subsequently changed his name.
So I think all these banks had stopped. And then recently they began opening up, with Goldman being the last, I think, to open an account with him last year. So it's quite a recent affair that his kind of misdemeanors were exonerated. And then the banks began working. I think they just were too greedy.
Apparently he was paying as much as $100 million in commissions to all these brokerages. So apparently Goldman Sachs was like, oh, you know.
Salivating.
$100 million US, you know, prime brokers were like, wow, this is a whale of a client. This is what they call when the client is top tier, right?
Real whale.
Yeah, real whale. And Goldman like gave in, or like allowed it to happen despite... I mean, he's kind of checkered legacy. I think that's, or checkered past. That's a very fair term, I think,
that's
for someone
right.
like this. But what was amazing is that even after he had his first brush with law in 2012, within 12 months, he was back in the game and he was pretty much forgiven.
Yep.
That is amazing. And this is according to an FT article.
Now, with every person, there's always the other side. And he, of course, is a Christian and has spoken about his faith publicly. In an interview posted on YouTube in 2008, he said one of his goals was to try to be a great investor where he would invest in companies that were benefiting society. Shouting, stop rolling your eyes.
I see. I think he was benefiting himself, but never mind. Continue.
So he recalled being a big investor in LinkedIn and he quoted, "Do I think God loves it? Of course," he said. "I'm like a little child looking for what can I do today? Where can I invest to please our God?"
I don't know what to say. I mean, there are all sorts of people that find ways to justify what they do. Fine, good to them, you know, good for them. But I think it doesn't detract from the fact that this guy is an interesting character, to put it at the, you know, politely, right? And he is known on Wall Street to be an aggressive money-making genius. This is according to one analyst who kind of saw Archegos grow from just about $200 million at its 2012 launch to almost $10 billion in just 9 years. So apparently, like I say, fee-hungry investment banks were so ravenous for Huang's trading commissions that they allowed him to magnify his bets to this level. And it just brings into question, what kind of scrutiny was going on at the bank level?
That's right.
And now, does this mean there's going to be more regulatory watch on all these kind of family offices or even hedge funds? As usual, let us know what you think. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we have the news bulletin, and to take us there is The Wanderer by Status Quo. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was Heroes by the late David Bowie. It has just gone past 6:39 in the morning, and of course you're listening to The Morning Run. Now, we've got one interesting tweet in response to whether we should make, you know, training compulsory, like certain kinds of training, gender training, diversity training. And Shamir Razak tweeted in and says, yeah, why not? My company got this online training system. Everything's assigned at certain interval and compulsory. Recently, he got ethical conduct, safety, personal conduct training. And I'm going to ask Shamir back in response, do you remember any of it? Because it's online.
We will give him a test.
We'll give him a test.
And it's a pass of 80%.
Yeah.
He has to pass it. If not, no job.
I suppose in this era, especially since a lot of us are working from home, there is really no choice. It has to be done online or Zoom, right? You can't in-house training, although that's going to change with effect, I think, from 1st of April, because the this SOP has been somewhat relaxed. But I think we have some interesting international headlines in front of us. And the first, of course, let's look to China, because China's top legislative body, the National People's Congress, has approved fundamental changes to Hong Kong's political system. So under the new rules, the number of directly elected seats in Hong Kong's parliament, the Legislative Council, has been reduced nearly in half. So the size of the LegCo is expanded from 70 to 90 seats. But the number, and this is the important part, the number of direct elected seats is cut down to 20 from 35.
That's shocking, because I think before this it was 35 out of 70, so about half of the parliament essential LegCo being directly elected. Now if it's 20 out of 90, it's only like less than a quarter.
Yeah, you keep diluting it.
You're diluting it substantially, and they did it by increasing the portion, and the portion being essentially just non-direct. And they even reduced the portion such a lot from 35 to 20.
And that's not all, Philip. Added to that is all prospective LegCo candidates will now have to go through two rounds of vetting before they can run, by the pro-Beijing election committee as well as by the new screening committee. And this will include background checks by the police and National Security Department. Now, the legal amendments will take into effect on Wednesday, and Hong Kong will change its local laws to reflect them in coming weeks. So we do know several local elections are coming up in 2021, and the first LegCo elections under the new rules is expected to be held in December.
What is the point of a one country, two system process?
What are you talking about?
What is that actually then?
I think that's like on paper, isn't it?
It's clearly on paper, because if you do this, essentially you're merging into one single system.
Yeah. So critics warn, of course, it seems that this will mean the end of democracy, and this will remove all opposition from the city's parliament. So the changes come after several opposition lawmakers were disqualified, which led to the entire opposition and LegCo resigning back in November. But, of course, Chief Executive Carrie Lam has insisted that the new rules did not shut out the opposition. And she said the vetting committee will not screen people out based on their political views, but rather weed out any non-patriots.
What I think the question here is the definition of patriots. It's such a broad umbrella, and it can be misinterpreted in so many ways. I suspect there will be a lot of protests. You have this summer of discontent that usually happens in Hong Kong in the quarter two leading up to August. I'm very keen in observing whether the government is going to use COVID as a reason to clamp down on protests. That's going to be shifting because in 2018, 2019, you saw the umbrella protests, all that kind of proliferating quite largely. 2020 was a bit more muted, but 2021, good to watch out what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, how angry will Hong Kong citizens be, right? How are they going to react? Are they going to return to street protests? Another question, of course, is how will the international community react? Are they just going to watch and let it happen? I mean, so far, the US has already slapped 34 individual sanctions on Hong Kong and Chinese officials for undermining Hong Kong's autonomy. And last June, the Trump administration removed Hong Kong's special status, with the island city treated the same as mainland China. Now, we do know Biden's in the White House, right?
Yep.
We have a new president. What's his tone going to be about this very important island city-state? Is it going to affect his relationship with China? What's the tone going to be? Is it going to be conciliatory? Is Hong Kong going to be a point of major point of discussion between these two countries?
Well, judging by the Alaska talks, I think, that took place about 2 weeks ago, sounds like it's going to be tense. Very keen to see how markets also should respond to these changes as well.
Yeah, and very quickly, the WHO also issued a report and has called into further investigation into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. And this is on the back of a mission to Wuhan, which still has left important questions unanswered.
Not bad, the boss publicly scold your own team, huh? Hey, why your report so lousy one?
What to do? But anyway, it's something we'll probably be looking at in more detail. But as usual, let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, the local newspapers and online portals. Don't go away. BFM 89.9. And that was Till Hear It From You by Gin Blossoms. It is 6:49 in the morning, Wednesday, the 31st of March, and you're listening to The Morning Run. And at this part of the morning, as usual, we are looking at all the online portals and newspapers in front of us. And I've got the Star headline, which says, "Choose wisely. With more than $50 billion approved for withdrawals through EPF iSina facility, shopping malls and Goldsmiths have seen a big jump in business." So while some are saving money and investing their money, people are advised to ensure they spend their cash on necessities. And I can tell you this headline.
A little too late.
A little too late and really, really, I have to say, worries me. Because the reason for your EPF is for your retirement.
Exactly.
And yes, I understand some people do need the cash desperately, right? They're out of a job, they've got severe, you know, major pay cuts, and they need it to put food on the table. But unless you're really honestly in that kind of dire situation where you're talking about basic necessities, you know, where you need to pay for some school fees, medical expenses, or you need to put food on the table, you should really, really not be taking that money to buy gold, an iPhone,
or stocks, or crypto, Bitcoin.
That's not the purpose of it, right? It just doesn't come across as wise financial planning.
It has got this global phenomenon and tinge to it. I think there was also the Biden $1.8 trillion stimulus when people are worried that there's this slosh of cash and liquidity going around everywhere and they don't know where to put the money because they think, oh, well, okay, I can just put it into the stock market. And I think that's what drove some valuations in the US. And the worry here is also, does it embolden the retail investors too much in Malaysia's side?
Yeah, I was listening to this podcast, I was listening to live Bloomberg Radio this morning and they interviewed the CEO of Jack in the Box, which is just like a fast food chain. And he said that he was going to have some labor issues in the months ahead when the stimulus comes out because a lot of people will be actually taking the stimulus checks and going on holiday rather than doing their, you know, their normal, let's say, full-time or part-time job at Jack in the Box. And I was like, huh? You know, I was like, it just baffles me. So I you're right. You know, there are some people who'll be very good with the stimulus checks. And there'll be some people who say, hey, this is a windfall. I'll just go and spend it.
Do you remember we had a conversation with our producer, Diana, where she said that, you know, her father went to a couple of restaurants and he said it was going to be very hard to hire people.
Even locally, right?
Locally, right, in Malaysia, because the iSina payments just gave people a bit more runway to not search for a job.
Yeah. Which begs the question whether, you know, this, yes, it probably does help some people, but, you know, it may not be necessary for everybody. And, you know, when the program was announced, whether certain tweaks should have been considered rather than a blanket approval. But, you know, questions that we'll find out. I mean, answers that we don't have at the moment, yeah. Right?
The next piece I wanted to share with you was on the Edge, where our Transport Minister Wee Ka-siong said ECRL, East Coast Rail Link implementation, is not politically motivated. I have my reservations about that, but I think this is a debate about the realignment of the East Coast Rail Link, because under the previous Pakatan Harapan government, after you go through from Pahang, it goes down south to Negeri Sembilan and then goes from the south to Port Klang, whereas the recent realignment proposed by the Barisan new Perikatan National Government was that it would basically go up north, Kapas, Serendah, and then down to Port Klang, but goes through Bentong.
Okay. I think in the first place, there were always question marks whether it, even if it was PH or PN, when it comes to this ECRL, did it ever make any sense? Will it ever pay for itself? Will it be a white elephant? Will we taxpayers end up paying for it? Or taxpayers' children, sorry, right? End up paying for it? I mean...
Yeah, I'm scratching my head because already the program is ongoing. The construction is taking place already. And this is, of course, the tiff between the Selangor state government and the federal government. You really need to get all the parties on board, actually, because this is a, you know, with respect to railway, it's a land issue. And I think the Selangor state probably has quite a lot of say over how the land is going to be used for these kind of infrastructure projects. And so the question I have in my mind is, why don't you get those plans all locked in before you do and begin the construction work?
Good question, Philip.
Because wouldn't you do the evaluation and say, okay, I can only make this work if I'm very clear that it lands at Port Klang through this alignment. And then all the numbers are kind of locked in and say, okay, jalan.
As usual, it's not jalan. It's a dead end at this moment. Or it's like, U-turn. But another piece of news is that the National Security Council has decided that effective April 1st, the ruling allowing only 30% of employees to work from office in the CMCO will be abolished. And this is in the Edge Markets News. So all you folk, you might get a call from your office or an email, if you haven't already, that you are going to be summoned back to the office.
But still no interstate travel.
Yes. And the CMCO for us has been extended.
Yes.
But that's all the news we have for you from the local papers this morning and online portals. Coming up next, this is 7am News Bulletin, followed by, of course, more business news and analysis, especially where global markets are headed, with Jack Kuzi, Director for Strategy at VFS Group. But first, here's Dreams by Fleetwood Mac, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.